Welcome to On the Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business, and the economy. On the Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2 SER and broadcast nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers, and this week we take a look at what Donald Trump may do to financial regulation like the Dodd-Frank Act.
The number one problem with the Volcker Rule is it's too complicated and people don't know how to interpret it. So we're going to look at what to do with it, as we are with all of Dodd-Frank, with the number one priority is going to be make sure that banks lend.
We also talked to a company that is bringing Australian design consumer electronics to the nation and find out how Afterpay is doing following their FinTech Award. All this and more coming up on The Money. First, US financial regulation looks to be set for an overhaul with the recent unveiling of the Financial Choice Act. Throughout President Trump's presidential campaign, he vowed to get rid of the Dodd-Frank Act, which was introduced by the Obama administration in the wake of the global financial crisis. But what exactly is the Dodd-Frank Act? Vincent Sue spoke with Marco Navone, senior lecturer in finance at the UTS Business School, to find out more.
What is the Dodd-Frank Act?
The Dodd-Frank Act is a law that was passed, introduced in the US in 2010 as a response to the global financial crisis. The Obama administration wanted to introduce some new regulations to avoid follow-up to the financial crisis, with banks taking again more and more risk and then requiring a bailout from the taxpayers. It's a very comprehensive regulation. Actually, I think I read some statistics, and within the Dodd-Frank Act, there are actually like 243 different sub-regulations. So it's a gigantic piece of regulation, very big, and also very difficult to analyze in its entirety because it's so big.
Why was it introduced, and what is it saying then?
Well, look, the idea is that in the lead-up to the global financial crisis, what happened is that the big banks started taking more and more risky positions. And usually when the economy goes well, these risky positions, they pay off big time and they made huge profits. But then when the economy turns down, you have these huge risks and banks, well, they can go bankrupt like everybody else. Problem is, if a big bank goes bankrupt, it's going to disrupt the whole economic system. So what happened is that the regulators or the government has to step in and bail out the bank using taxpayers' money. To avoid that, they introduced the Dodd-Frank Act.
What do you think is the most significant part of the law?
There are many parts of the law that are quite significant. I think that the most significant are two. One is the fact that now in the U.S., you used to have every bank subject to the same type of regulation. But now regulators in the U.S., they can single out a bank and say, you are systemically relevant, you are very big, and for your size or for your particular position within the financial system, you are systemically relevant. So we can subject you to additional regulation, and that's new. And the other element of the Dodd-Frank Act that is one of the most controversial is the so-called Volcker Rule. Paul Volcker is a former chairman of the Federal Reserve, and he was the one to introduce this piece of regulation. And the Volcker Rule basically says, if you're a bank, a normal bank, and you have deposits and you give mortgages, etc., you cannot engage in risky financial activities such as investing in hedge funds or doing what is called proprietary trading. So trade, buy and sell stocks and bonds with your own money. So, and this is very interesting because this actually was in the law, in the American law, since 1929, the so-called Glass-Steagall Act that separated banking from the stock market. But then in the 90s, Bill Clinton overcame this and went back allowing banks to trade in stocks and bonds. And this led to the global financial crisis. So the Volcker Rule reintroduced basically the separation between banks and stock trading activities.
You mentioned the Glass-Steagall Act. What's the major difference between the Dodd-Frank Act and the Glass-Steagall Act?
Well, no, they are very different because the Glass-Steagall Act was introduced in 1930 after the the banking crisis of 1929. I think, if I remember correctly, the Glass-Steagall Act is 1933. So that was a completely different financial system, a completely different type of environment. So the Glass-Steagall Act was, I think, I'm not an expert, but I think it was much simpler, much smaller, and that basically this one big provision of separating banking activity from stock trading and bond trading. Now, the Dodd-Frank is born out of a similar situation, so another huge economic and financial crisis, but is a much bigger regulation. And within this regulation, there is also this provision that is quite similar to what originally was the Glass-Steagall Act.
What are some of the most criticized aspects of the Dodd-Frank Act, particularly by the Trump administration?
Well, look, the most criticized element of the Dodd-Frank Act is the fact that it involves a lot of what is called compliance. So banks have to basically do a lot of paperwork and comply with this big regulation. They need to collect information and present this information to the regulators, etc. So they say it's very expensive to abide by these rules, basically to collect all this information and follow these compliance rules. So they say, especially for small banks, it's very difficult to comply with this regulation. Also, the Volcker Rule is a bit controversial because nowadays it's not very simple to separate trading activities that banks are not allowed to do from what is called market-making activities, basically banks trading stocks, providing liquidity to the market. Some colleagues at UTS have done some research on this, and it turns out that after the introduction of the Dodd-Frank Act, liquidity for some securities, especially corporate bonds, went down. So the idea is, if you are in a hurry to sell a bond, sometimes you don't find a bank on the other side willing to trade with you because the Dodd-Frank Act is telling the bank that they should not trade. So these are pretty controversial elements. But generally speaking, I think that the Trump administration is following this, in this area, is following a bit the general Republican idea that regulations is bad. And also, we have to say that there is a lot of lobbying from banks in the U.S. to overcome the Dodd-Frank Act, because, of course, this act is limiting what the banks can do. And specifically, the fact that they cannot trade is quite harmful for their profitability. So they say, well, we want to be profitable, so we would like you to repeal the Dodd-Frank Act. I don't think that the Trump administration is against any specific provision, more the whole idea of regulating the financial system so tightly. Of course, the Volcker Rule, so the separation of banking from trading, is the most controversial one.
So do you think the Trump administration will succeed in changing the act?
Well, that's very difficult to say because the act is so big that probably what they can do is to eliminate some specific portions. For example, one of the smaller things, but also quite relevant, that the Dodd-Frank introduced was the creation of the so-called Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection. This is an office that basically collects complaints of normal people against banks, you know, when the bank is violating contracts or this type of things. Now, this is in the law, but what the Trump administration is doing is simply reducing the funding to this authority. So the authority is not technically eliminated, but if you reduce funding, you are going to basically render this authority useless because they don't have enough money to work.
The Trump administration is putting Dodd-Frank under review, including the Volcker Rule. Here's Trump's Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin.
The number one problem with the Volcker Rule is it's too complicated and people don't know how to interpret it. So we're going to look at what to do with it, as we are with all of Dodd-Frank, with the number one priority is going to be make sure that banks lend.
With the possible loss of the Volcker Rule and the Dodd-Frank regulations, could the United States be sowing the seeds of another global financial crisis?
Marco Navone there, Senior Lecturer in Finance at the University of Technology Sydney School of Business, speaking with Vincent Tsu. You're listening to On the Money, giving you the lowdown on everything financial. I'm Roderick Chambers.
It's business time. It's business. It's business time.
I know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say it's time for business. It's business time.
Ooh, it's business.
Well, you may be buying a lot of electronics online, but what about Australian-designed electronics? There is a new website called smate.com.au which does exactly that. It sells exclusively Aussie-designed electronics. I spoke with Managing Director Sunny Barson to find out exactly what SMATE is.
So in terms of what we have as a business with SMATE, look, it was something that started out nearly a year ago, wherein a bunch of us engineers basically came together and had a look at what other sort of platforms, products we actually got in the consumer electronics space. When you talk about platforms, typically when we explore and have a look, most of the platforms that we've got are typical retailing platforms that will sell any products. There are a few, however, similar to, let's say, Kogan, who do sell their own branded products, but it's limited in number. And that's the probably only Australian company out there which is selling their products. So there was definitely a gap in the market where we don't have many Australian products, consumer electronic products out there in the market. So a bunch of us came together and thought about it, all right, how best can we actually solve this problem?
And these are Australian manufactured products, are they?
So in terms of the manufacturing, at this point in time, it's been outsourced to three different countries, but they're Australian design products.
So it's things that you can't really get on other websites because you're specialising in Australian design products.
That is correct. It's Australia. You can get products anywhere in the world nowadays. It's very easy with the internet to actually Google things and find out products. It's the actual quality and the design and the price points which will typically differentiate us and the brand that is actually an Australian product from the other competitors out there.
And are you doing the distribution yourself, or have you got a partner to do the distribution for you?
Yeah, so we've got an online platform which is www.smate.com.au, that's S-M-A-T-E, smate.com.au. We currently distribute our products through that online platform. At the same time, we are establishing other channel partners who exist on online platforms where typical users would actually go to actually get the products out there.
And how did you get to the point of starting this up? When the group of you got together, you said, had someone had an idea and said, you know, look, we think we can do this?
Yeah, so typically, I mean, we were discussing in terms of, you know, buying a television. That's where it all started from. And then we looked at various sort of options available and the price points and the technology they actually end up using, where are they manufactured and whatnot. And then we started to, you know, it kind of between the friends of us, it started from a small little discussion, which and then we started to explore other sort of electronic gadgets and products out there. And very quickly, we realized that, you know, we don't actually have an Australian brand out there. Whilst we've got a number of European players, Sennheisers, Bose, we've got Sony's and Samsung and LG's and whatnot. There's no one good quality sort of an Australian brand out there in this space. So then from that point onwards, it was very clear for us to actually basically, you know, go out with the Australian brand and actually take it to the Australian customers and also take it worldwide.
And are you finding it easy to supply overseas markets? Are there any challenges there in getting your stuff sent overseas?
Yeah, so we are in the early stages. We are opening up channel partners, if you like, to start branding our products in the overseas market. And typically, right now, we're actually targeting a number of countries, if you like, where we can establish those channel partners to actually move our brand and then also do branding and then sell the products down there. So far, the feedback that we've got, people, customers, suppliers, contractors, staff, they're quite excited by the fact that it's an Australian product, although it may be made in China or Hong Kong or Taiwan, but at least it's an Australian product, which is actually getting out there.
And are you finding that you're looking at now a bigger model and you're needing to look at different kind of financing, or how are you going with the financing of the business at the moment?
It's like anything else in the early stages. We wish that we actually had very deep pockets. But in terms of, you know, financing, yes, we did put together a pool of money. Hopefully we can get enough legs in the next due course to actually see that churning through from a cash flow perspective. wherein then we can approach investors or banks and other institutions out there who would be interested in financing our company.
Because, you know, often businesses find that once they go overseas, you know, the size of the markets overseas suddenly overwhelms them a little bit with the amount of orders they can get in a short space of time. Mm. And then fulfilling those orders can be a problem, and then financing becomes a problem. So have you looked at all that sort of thing with your business model?
Yeah, we're quite conscious of the fact in terms of financing, the supply chain model that we've established, the suppliers that we've actually established, the number of units, the quality of the products that they can actually churn out, the inventory days, the life cycle of all of that in terms of being able to warehouse, distribute, freight providers, and all of that. We've invested a lot of time in the business model to actually, you know, have it initially based in Australia and then scale it to a worldwide model.
Well, it sounds great. It sounds like you're well on the way to brand dominance and success, I suppose. Thanks very much, Sonny, for talking to us here and On the Money. If you want to look at some of the SMATE products, you just look up at smate.com.au, don't you? S-M-A-T-E. Very easy. You can see exactly the sort of products that Sonny's been talking about. So thank you, Sonny, for being on the Money.
No worries. Thanks a lot, Rod. By the way, before I leave, I'll just say this, that effectively SMATE, for the listeners who might be wondering what it stands for, it actually stands for Smart Mate. So it's actually got some logic to it. It's just not a word picked out of air.
I should have asked you that at the beginning, shouldn't I?
That's okay. We also actually offer community benefits discounts to people who might be struggling with cash flow, typically students and pensioners. We offer them extra support by offering them extra discounts when they register on smate.com.au.
Well, I think that'll set you apart from many of your competitors. I don't think many competitors in the electronics space do anything like that. So congratulations on thinking of that. And all right. Well, thanks again, Sonny. I wish you well with SMATE, and I'm sure it sounds like it's doing very well already. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. All right. Thanks a lot for your time, Rod. Bye.
Sonny Barson there, one of the founders of SMATE. You're listening to On the Money around Australia on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers.
On the Money, making mountains out of moolah.
I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to On the Money, broadcast live on the Community Radio Network. Well, have you ever seen that special thing you wish to purchase on sale, but, you know, funds were just a little bit tight? Well, years ago, you might have put items on lay-by or something like that, but these days it's more likely to go onto the credit card. But there's now more options for shoppers on a budget, and Afterpay is a product which has won a FinTech Prize for their innovative approach. Apparently, you can have your cake and eat it too. Jason LaQuia spoke to Managing Director of Afterpay, Nick Molnar, to describe just how Afterpay worked.
So the way Afterpay works is when someone goes online or in-store and wants to buy a retail product, let's say they want to buy a $100 dress, rather than spending $100, the customer pays four payments of $25. So the customer can take the product straight away or it's sent to their home straight away, and then they pay Afterpay through four payments every fortnight, so a payment every 2 weeks.
Always four payments?
Always four payments. So it's the same across all of our retail partners. So some of our retail partners include Cotton On, Country Road, Supercheap Auto. We've got a very diverse range of retailers, over 4,000 retailers live on the platform, and it's the same product across all retailers.
What are some of the benefits to retailers? What are the incentives for retailers to participate in Afterpay or to utilize Afterpay as a tool?
So So we've had really rapid retail uptake. We had 100 retailers live on the platform in August 2015, so a little bit over 18 months ago. We've now got over 4,000 retailers. And the main reason why retailers offer the Afterpay service is they want to offer customers flexibility and affordability when shopping. Retail's moving very much towards a very customer-centric mind. And from Afterpay's perspective, we are unashamedly in the customer's favour. They pay nothing extra to buy their items. And from a retailer's perspective, they love it because they're giving their customers a fantastic experience.
So for retailers, their incentive is that they get more people who might be on the fence about buying a larger item because they don't have the money up front. And so they get those people, they bring those people in through the doors and they increase their numbers.
Yeah, exactly. So from a retailer's perspective, it's all about increasing conversion rates and making sure that they can engage with their customers and sell more to their customers. And it makes sense because when you look at a $100 item, the $25 breakdown is far easier, it's far more affordable for customers to manage. So from a retailer's perspective, they're happy because they sell more. And from a customer's perspective, they're also really happy because it costs them nothing extra.
Okay. And I guess on the back end, is there a transaction charge for retailers per transaction?
Yeah, so we charge our retailers a commission per sale, but only when a sale's made. We pay the retailer straight away, so we pay the retailer next business day, and then we assume all the risks. So it's our responsibility to recover money from our customers in the future on the payment due dates.
I see. And I'm not sure if you mentioned this earlier, but Afterpay is interest-free, is that right? Fee-free, interest-free?
Yeah, so we charge the customer nothing extra. So when they're buying a $200 item, it's costing the customer four payments of $50. So it's completely interest-free for the customer. Retailer pays us the transaction fee. So we've really shifted the economics in favor of the customer. We charge the retailer, not the customer.
Okay, and what happens if a customer forgets to make a payment?
So all of our payments are completely automated. So our customers provide us their debit or credit card that they want to automatically be billed in the future, and they submit their order. We then send SMS reminders to our customers, and we automatically bill them on those due dates. If the customer doesn't make their payment, we do charge a $10 late fee, but it's a flat late fee on all orders.
Okay, and you recently released an app to assist customers with, you know, the communication, I guess, of when the payments are due, the remaining balance, et cetera, et cetera. How has that been received?
Yeah, so we launched our app about 2 weeks ago, and within the first week we went to number one on the App Store, which was an incredible testament to our team and how passionate our customers are about our product. The main purpose of the app is primarily at shopping both online and in-store. So if you want to go into the Afterpay app, you can get your barcode, go buy in-store, and then take the item home. So it was very amazing in such a short period of time to go to number one on the App Store. And it was a fantastic milestone for the Afterpay team.
Yeah, impressive. And very recently, you won an award. I believe they're called a Finny. What is a Finny, and what is this award that you won?
Yeah, so we're really excited to win Australia's Best FinTech Organisation just this week. So FinTech is a financial and technology company, so there's some amazing FinTech companies in the Australian market, and we were very privileged to win the prize there. And, you know, especially for us from our products team's perspective, from our technical team's perspective, it was a fantastic testament to the products that we've built and then ultimately how we've engaged with our customers through those products. So, a great way to top off the start of the year.
And what is the profile of winning FinTech of the Year? How will that impact the business? Do you think that'll have, increase the profile?
Yeah, so, look, I think it's a huge testament to what we've been able to achieve. From our perspective, the most important thing for us is how we just keep engaging with as many customers as possible and then in turn engaging with as many retailers as possible. And this award is just a testament to what we've been able to achieve over the past 18 months and then also, continuing our growth profile going forward.
Great. And lastly, it should have been first. I'll edit around this. How did Afterpay, what's the inception story? How did it start?
So I come from a retail background, so my family is in jewelry, and I started selling jewelry on eBay out of my bedroom when I was at uni. I actually sold the most jewelry on eBay in the country when I was 19, and then I ended up launching a big jeweler from the States into Australia, and that kind of taught me everything I knew and now know about retail. And what it did expose me to was how installments were being processed, particularly in America, in quite a big way. So opened my eyes up to the market and really saw how when there's a truly customer-centric product that's in the market, how customers react to it and the rapid take-up. So, you know, we really came at it from a retail background, which enabled us to build a, you know, very customer-centric retail service tool.
Okay, thanks for your time and best of luck.
No problem, thank you.
Afterpay Managing Director Nick Molnar there, ending that report by Jason LeCuyer. And that's all we have for you on the Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about money, finance and business. On the Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network. Thanks to our producers, Vincent Su and Jason LeCuyer. You can find all of our shows and stories at 2ser.com/onthemoney. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your favourite podcast app. Put it on your friends' phones as well. Follow us on Twitter. Look for @onthemoney2ser and follow us on Facebook. I'm Roderick Chambers, and we'll be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks for your company.
UTS Haverfield Club offers great quality food with terrific views and is just a short trip from the city. Open every day, your Sunday long lunch is soundtracked by the Sunday Sessions live musicians, making UTS Haverfield Club's dining experience one to truly savour. Whatever the occasion, you'll be inspired by the delicious menu and the superb location on Iron Cove Bay. Visit utshaverfield.com.au for info and bookings. Sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
The old songs are the best songs after all.
I'm Greg Poppleton.
Let's dance!
Every Tuesday, right here on 2SER FM, I bring you the Phantom Dancer. Swing and dance in selections taken mostly from live radio broadcasts from the late 1920s into the 1960s.
Let's dance!
It's Australia's longest-running swing dance show, and you can hear it every Tuesday at 12 noon right here on 2SER FM 107.3 in Sydney and 2SER.com.
Grip your partner's arm tightly, throw back your head, and while the lights are low, listen to the moaning instruments.
These school holidays bring your creative kids along to one of Australia's longest-running festivals for children, the Way Out West Festival at Casula Powerhouse, Liverpool, from the 12th to the 15th of July. Celebrating imagination, spontaneity, creativity and storytelling, the festival explores the art of play for the child inside and the child beside you. Tickets are on sale now at wayoutwestfestival.com.au. Casula Powerhouse Liverpool, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
Where are you getting your daily dose of reading? Are you an ardent book shopper? Are you an e-reader fanatic? Do you ever get out and hit up some live storytelling? My name is Andrew Popel, and Final Draft is, of course, that half hour every Saturday morning where we sit back, relax with a good book and talk reading and literary culture.
Final Draft. Books, writing and publishing.
Telling stories is such a human thing to do.
Saturday mornings from 10 on 2SER 107.3.